You know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout, throw my hands up and shout, throw my head back and shout. Come on now, don't forget to say you will. Don't forget to say yeah, 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 yeah.
Say you will.
Say it right now, baby.
Say you will.
Come on, come on.
Say you will.
Say it better, yeah.
Say you will.
Come on now. Say that you love me. Say that you need me. Say that you want me. You want
live from New York City, it's the Gary Knowles Show. And now, your host, Gary Knowles.
I still remember.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knowles. Today, we have so much information to share. I want to get right into it. We're going to give you the latest on health and healing, as we do every day. Then, to help you better understand my comments, that we have a fascist dictator who will be running Brazil, and that does not bode well for the lungs of the planet, the Amazon. And we're going to talk about the rebirth of military dictatorships in Latin America. My guest from Brazil by Skype will be a Professor Aline Cristina Piva. She is the Assistant Deputy Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington, D.C., and the founder of the organization's Brazil Research Unit. And the Council is a liberal research and information nonprofit dedicated to promoting constructive American and Canadian policies towards Latin American nations. She is also currently a professor of international law at the Bolivarian University in Venezuela. And so that'll be an interesting conversation. Also today, we're going to listen to some thoughts from Chris Hedges. His speech is called American Psychoses. If time permits, a short piece from Professor Jonathan Jordan Peterson on what every parent needs to know. Now, we won't have time today for Professor Peter Goetze on why few patients benefit, many are harmed by orthodox medicine, and a very important piece I'll be playing soon called Free Speech at What Cost. These will be upcoming. Also, we are finishing today, I worked on it last night, earlier this morning, on a completely different perspective than anything I've ever seen on the environment. And I'm getting these new insights. It'll be aired probably Friday and then published at the same time. Let us begin with the latest on health and healing. And first off, we have the risk factors for type 2 diabetes and congestive heart failure accumulate in children with poor aerobic fitness. This is from the University of Eastern Finland, published in the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Science and Sports. And what it simply says is that the risk factors for type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease accumulate in children who have poor aerobic fitness. The study also found that the traditional way of expressing aerobic fitness in proportion to total body mass overestimates the role of aerobic fitness in identifying children at an increased risk. So, in lay language, when young children are not exercising and really getting out running and playing and jumping and screaming and all the things kids normally do and should do, when they're spending too much time in front of televisions, computers, laptops, and telephones, they're automatically put at risk of diabetes, unstable levels of insulin and glucose, elevated HDL cholesterol and triglycerides, increases in blood pressure, diabetes and cardiovascular disease. All that from a young kid. So we're finding more and more about why we're diseased as we age, and exercise is crucial to it. From Medical University of Japan, cacao, that's chocolate, is found to have a powerful inhibitory effect on influenza virus infections. Research in Japan found that chocolate can provide strong protection against the influenza virus. The study was published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Science in Food and Agriculture, and the research examined the protective effects of cacao on the influenza virus using both laboratory testing and clinical trials. So what do we know? Well, the latest research shows that cacao contains a biologically active set of ingredients that are antimicrobial, antiviral, and inhibit the effect of the influenza virus infection. That's important. And so the human intervention trials, they consume cacao for 3 weeks. The other group did not. Made an enormous difference in the group that did. One more reason to have your healthy chocolate each day. Now, mind you, there's healthy chocolate. That would be 60% and higher in total cacao. And then there is unhealthy chocolate, the milk chocolate loaded with processed sugar. Take the one that is healthy, not the one that's not. From the University of Surrey, which is in the United Kingdom, plus the University of Dusseldorf, which is in Germany, a new study on blue light. So exposure to blue light decreases blood pressure, reducing the risk of developing cardiovascular disease. That's interesting. During this study, published in the prestigious Journal of European Preventive Cardiology, participants were exposed to 30 minutes of whole-body blue light at approximately 450 nanometers, a dose comparable to daily sunlight, followed by exposure to a controlled light on a different day. Visible blue light, as opposed to ultraviolet light, is not carcinogenic. To assist the impact, participants' blood pressure, stiffness of arteries and blood vessel dilation and blood plasma levels of nitric oxide stores were measured before, during, and up to 2 hours after the lights were given. And the blood pressure dropped. Cardiovascular disease was lessened. Researchers also found that exposure to blue light increased levels of nitric oxide, which is very important because it's a signaling molecule that protects the cardiovascular system. It's believed that the blue light releases from the skin into the bloodstream, where it relaxes the blood vessels, increasing blood flow and decreasing blood pressure. So again, we like to bring you information you will not read or heard about elsewhere that's published in peer-reviewed literature from prestigious institutions that's ahead of the curve by a long measure. Oh, and by the way, this is just as an aside, but I was thinking about this recently because I've done a lot of traveling. And there was a study that tried to debunk the idea that there's a lot of bacteria in bathrooms. And so they took samples from the seat of toilets and found that ice cubes in a fast food restaurant had more fecal contamination and bacteria than did a toilet seat. Now think of that for a moment. That would be completely understandable, but they took the wrong sample. They should have taken a sample from underneath the toilet seat, because every time you flush a toilet, it's like a toilet sneezing. So the particulate matter is going to be hitting, in men, their testicles and upper back thighs and buttock, and the same with a woman. So people should never flush the toilet while they're sitting on it. That's just gross, and you're going to just have thousands of bacteria and fecal particles all over you. That can migrate into the urethra and cause infection, which is very high in the United States. We're talking about millions of women have a shorter urethra and bladder infections. So I was thinking about how they made a statement, but they didn't test the right part. I remember at the Institute once we had some people coming down with some sicknesses. Nobody knew why. Flu-like symptoms. And I was working upstairs on the third floor. They were downstairs. So we simply did an experiment. One day, there was a commonly used bathroom, and I said, spread agar. So two of us went in there, and we cleaned it with bleach. Then we put agar, which is a medium that bacteria grow in, use it in little petri dishes, over the entire single, every single inch of the bathroom. Then we simply asked for one volunteer to go in there when they had to go to the bathroom and leave the toilet seat down. And then the next time someone used it, leave the toilet seat up. Now, remember, all public bathrooms have no toilets, no covers to toilets. So when they flush, everything goes in the air. And then there was a simple machine. You can go in and it's like a wand, and it automatically reads bacteria and viruses. There were over 500,000 bacteria from one single flush with a lid open. Very few from the lid down. So I put up a sign saying, here we have all these MD, PhDs working in this institute, and evidently in your education, you weren't told how to put a toilet seat down before you flush the toilet. Oh, man, they didn't like that at all. They had no sense of humor. But it's true. If people only knew how many people die or get sick each year in hospitals because of surgeons, nurses, orderly, not understanding proper hygiene and in spreading infections, especially during surgery. Anyhow, it's just this idea that we're not paying attention to the basics like hygiene. So anyhow, what I did was I then put up around all the doors blue lights, and that blue light kills bacteria. So I was surprised they didn't have the blue light before, but every single room had blue light that reduced all these infectious and many of the pathogenic bacteria, and that's why you have blue light. Blue light is a spectrum that can kill, which takes us back to Royal Rife, and I won't do anything now on Royal Rife, but he was right. He killed cancer cells by harmonizing vibrations of light that matched the cancer cell and that shattered them. Anyhow, more on that. So blue light can reduce blood pressure. That's the meaning of that. Next story, Qigong. Qigong is a traditional Chinese exercise. University of Sain, Malaysia says that it can help you reduce hypertension and lower your blood pressure. Two major killers in our society. That's important. And it just helps practitioners cultivate what is known as the qi, or vital life force, through different techniques. And there are various forms and styles of qigong, and they can either heal you, improve your physical attributes, or help you achieve enlightenment. It's all possible when you move qi around in the body. So if a person has hypertension, their systolic blood pressure and diastolic blood pressure are constantly elevated. And when high blood pressure is left untreated, it can cause severe health problems like cardiovascular and cerebrovascular and renal morbidity. It can even cause death. But according to the scientists in this study in Malaysia, they looked at people suffering from primary hypertension or high blood pressure that doesn't have a known secondary cause. And alarmingly, most cases of the condition are undiagnosed. And thankfully, the traditional Chinese exercise called Qigong had positive effects on individuals with this condition. The study's authors wanted to confirm if a 5-day, 1-minute Qigong exercise program could help lower blood pressure of people who had primary hypertension. And they conducted an open-label parallel group controlled trial on the staff of the university, and these people had primary hypertension. And after sorting everyone by groups, they found that it worked. So this was published in the journal Focus on Alternative and Complementary Therapies. Now, very few people in Manhattan or the boroughs around Manhattan have tried it. Generally, you have to find someone who is well-experienced. More often than not, these people come from China, South Korea, or Japan. And it's taken decades of study because they have to ground their own energy and then be able to control energy. Now, I was doing a documentary about 15 years ago on de-stress naturally, and I found a person using Qigong, and we took a person who had lower back constant pain and inflammation. No other therapy had worked. We had tried other therapies just to see, acupuncture, trigger point therapy, Alexander technique. None of it worked. And I was directing and standing right beside the person, and as he did this meditation, he did a meditation for about a half hour before he put his hands not on the body, but about 2 or 3 inches above it, and you could feel the heat. Even though I'm right behind him, I could feel the heat. And this was in the wintertime. It wasn't necessarily warm in that office where he was, but the person's whole body. Now, what was interesting is the person was laying down with his head in a cradle. He couldn't see where the person was, and the person wasn't touching him. But the moment his hand went above this place on the person's body, the lower back, the person, you could see the muscles, and the whole body began to relax. And later when I asked the person, I said, what did you feel? He said, I felt this incredible warmth, this very deep warmth, and I thought for a moment someone had put a heating pad on me because it got very warm and then hot. And I said, no, that there was no heating pad. That was just a person's hands, and it wasn't on your body. It was about 3 inches above your body. And this is what Qigong can do. So if you have headaches, if you have fatigue, if you have Lyme's disease, chronic fatigue syndrome, cancer, you should definitely consider as one part of your therapy Qigong. But don't get one of these 17th degree grandmaster healer princesses from another planet, all nonsense. Find someone who has got deep experience, preferably someone who has grown up with it, studied it, it has been a part of their life work. They're around. A lot of them are down in Chinatown. I've been mentioning on a few shows the power of epigenetics, or what happens in early life impacts us in later life. Michigan State University did a study, and they found that your perceptions of your parents directly affects your physical health and wellness. And regardless, if they're true, you might be stuck with them for life. Quote, there are things that happen to us in life that can alter our perceptions of the past, but it's not always the objective or what actually happened that really affects us. What really impacts adults is how we psychologically interpret things and create memories. In short, our memories are of our childhood predicted health and depression, even though they may not even be based upon reality. This is important, and this was published in Health Psychology. So the takeaway message here is simple. People with the not-so-happy memories are the people that are found to be more sicker. This includes people who have chronic illness and depression, and they describe colder, more negative memories of their parents. On the other hand, healthy people had warmer, more positive thoughts of their upbringings. Now, this was irrespective of whether they actually had a good or bad upbringing. Remember, your conditioning is so palatable that you can have people who tell you that you had a good or bad upbringing. Like a lot of therapists, unfortunately, did in the 1980s. They told people that they were sure they were abused, and people who had no abuse suddenly, for the first time, remembered they were abused when they were 2 years old. It was all nonsense, but it didn't stop people from believing it. All the more reason, if you are depressed, if you are anxious, if you hold negative memories about your parents, they may not be true. You may believe they're true, and that's adversely affecting your health and will for the rest of your life. That's when I suggest you go to a professional, licensed clinical psychologist who is an expert in regressive hypnosis. What is regressive hypnosis? It's the capacity to take a person back in time where they actually, and I've seen it, where they actually speak like little children. And I'll give you one example. Dr. Donald Mullen used to do this. A lot of my friends who were psychologists, some of my closest friends were psychiatrists and psychologists, and they would do this. And what you would do is you would take a person back, and then you get them clear back to a very early age, and then you show them a book, and you say on one side are very good and happy pictures, and the other side are ones that we're not happy about. Describe the pictures. And by bringing them year by year through this, you'll be able to determine whether or not what they were thinking and believing was real or not real. And that's when they can help then correct this. I won't go into it now. I'll save this for another program about the power to change negative thoughts from our past into positive outcomes today. But that's one of the reasons they found this. And this was a big study, 15,000 adults. So, happy thoughts about childhood, healthier adult life. Negative thoughts about childhood, sicker, more depressed and anxious throughout our entire lives. And finally, from Iowa State University, singing may reduce stress, improve motor functions for people with Parkinson's disease. That's important. So if you have Parkinson's, one of the things you can do, and this was shown at the Society for Neuroscience at their national conference, is you can sing. It doesn't matter whether you're in tune or not. Just singing can help deal with sadness, anxiety, and anger, things that frequently people with Parkinson have. And the session should be about 1 hour of singing a day. And it does work. And at the All India Institute for Medical Science, published in the Journal of Herbal Medicine, blood cancers can be treated safely and naturally with cinnamon. Cinnamon does more than add a pleasant and appetizing aroma to your favorite dishes. It can also help treat certain cancers. Melanoma is a type of blood cancer. And another name for it is multiple myeloma. And it's not as rare as other types of cancer. About 2% of all cancer deaths in the United States it's related to. And myelomas, however, are a dangerous disease. Only about 50% of the people survive the 5 years after diagnosis. So the authors of the study looked at cinnamon as a possible natural alternative treatment for this disease. Why? Because cinnamon is a very powerful anti-inflammatory, especially if you use, I would say, Jamaican cinnamon. Very strong anti-inflammatory, antibacterial, anti-angiogenic. And it worked. They obtained human myeloma cell line RPM18226 and treated it with cinnamon bark powder extract. The authors noted a concentration of 72 micrograms per milliliter caused 50% inhibition of cell growth rate in the treated cancer cells compared to the untreated controls. That's a big deal. I'm not suggesting that it's the end-all and be-all. I'm simply saying what we look at each day here is just pieces of a puzzle. You may have 1,000 pieces, but it's a good piece. Just like, for example, the University of Navarro in Spain, they found that eating berries, all berries, slashes your inflammatory rate and health risk caused by obesity substantially. And when you consider that 40% of the entire American population is overweight, and a lot of those are obese, and that leads to chronic degenerative diseases like heart disease, cancer, diabetes, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and dementia, then eating berries is a sure way of helping. It's inexpensive. It's easy to do. It's good for you. So eating berries is a natural way to help limit the negative effects of obesity. And this was published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry. One more reason for those of you eating your berries or drinking berry juice or berry concentrate or Barry Powders. You're on the right side of science. And by the way, Medical University of Warsaw, eat your vegetables. Another reason why they may promote heart health. And that was published in the Journal of Physiology, Heart and Circulatory Physiology. More vegetables you eat, the healthier your heart, the lower your triglycerides, lower your cholesterol. But I'm sure many of you already knew that because you're eating a healthy diet. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to come back in a moment. We're going to come right back into listening to Chris Hedges. I think he has something to say that we all should hear at this moment in time. It's entitled American Psychoses. Back in a moment.
Struggle with our own mortality, the search for a life of meaning, love, the capacity for transformation. Those forces are ones that make us stop and become introspective and think and look within ourselves to see who we are and where we're going. And that's what any totalitarian state seeks to crush. And yet, we kind of blissfully have checked out. Most people have no concept of how fragile their environment is. I think you have to, have, as I have done, live in societies that collapse to realize how quickly they go down and how fragile they are. And so there's a kind of emotional incapacity to understand collapse, even when it's facing you. I spent 20 years outside the United States, and I had covered, as a foreign correspondent, totalitarian cultures, everything from the East German Stasi state to Slobodan Milosevic's Serbia. So I know how totalitarian systems work. I know the kind of dark emotions they evoke. I know the mechanisms they use to shut down dissent. And when I came back, it was utterly apparent that the country had gone collectively insane in a very frightening way. Not only their misunderstanding of the wider world, something as a foreign correspondent I was very cognizant of, but their misunderstanding of who they were and where they were going. The nature of illusion is that it's designed, at least at the moment, to make you feel good about yourself, about your country, about where you're going. In that sense, it functions like a drug. Those who question that illusion are challenged not so much for the veracity of what they say, but for puncturing those feelings. Attempt to get up and question where we're going and who we are. And the critique will be that you're such a pessimist, that you're such a cynic, that you're not an optimist. Optimism becomes a kind of disease. It's what created the financial meltdown, where you have this kind of cheerful optimism in the face of utter catastrophe, and you plow forward based on an optimism that is no longer rooted in reality. If hope becomes something that you express through illusion, then it's not hope, it's fantasy. The cult of the self is, in biblical terms, a form of idolatry. Everything is about you. Whether it's the worship of power or money, it all goes back to the self. It all goes back to creating little monuments to yourself. All investment into a particular goal of self-aggrandizement is a kind of pathetic attempt at self-exaltation in a kind of maybe even subconscious way at immortality. We have replicated the patterns that past civilizations in collapse underwent. An elite that is no longer connected with the real, that retreats into their bubbles, like the Forbidden City or Versailles, and yet has total economic and political power. The crumbling of infrastructure, civilizations always decay, their cities go first, we've already done that. The retreat into illusion. The danger is that this time when we go down, the whole planet's going to go with us. The corporate state has made a war against critical thinking, and in particular the humanities, because the humanities at their best are about teaching people how to think rather than what to think. They're about teaching people to challenge assumptions and structures. The discipline of the humanities is subversive. It's meant to be subversive. The other thing that the failure to think critically does is it creates a very frightening historical amnesia. So you don't know how you got here. You don't know where you came from. And again, that is something that popular culture, let's call it totalitarian capitalism, seeks to put in place so that people interpret their problems as personal problems rather than political or social problems. When you don't understand what's going on, when you imbibe the illusion that you're fed, the belief that reality is never an impediment to what you desire, that you can have everything you want, that blinds you. It keeps you from seeing what's happening around you. Then, because you are intellectually and emotionally unprepared, you scream for moral renewal and a new savior and a demagogue and vengeance. And at that point, you vomit it up, these very frightening figures. So the lunatic fringe of our political establishment, which is often laughed at by even a majority of the populace, in moments like that suddenly seizes power. You can oftentimes, in moments of breakdown, have a society clamor for their own enslavement. The cost that we're paying is that the forces arrayed against us are going to kill us. Unfettered, unregulated capitalism is a revolutionary force, as Karl Marx understood. It exploits everything. Everything becomes a commodity. Human beings become commodities, the natural world becomes a commodity that it exploits until exhaustion or collapse. And that's why the environmental crisis is intimately twinned with the economic crisis. 40% of the summer Arctic sea ice melts. And that becomes a business opportunity for Shell that's up there dropping $500 million drill bits down into the Arctic Sea. It's insane. When societies reach the kind of end stage, the language they use to describe their own economic and political and social and cultural reality bears no resemblance to that reality, which is where we are. The language of free market, laissez-faire capitalism is what they feed business students and the wider public, but it is an ideology that bears absolutely no resemblance to the reality, and that gets back to the fact that of living in a kind of culture warped by pervasive illusion and self-delusion. Totalitarian societies, by their nature, are hyper-masculine cultures and seek to banish empathy. They not only ignore the vulnerable and the weak, but they ridicule them and persecute them. They celebrate supposed values of force, strength, violence, and empathy is seen as weakness. I mean, in a free market society, all of those companies like Goldman Sachs would have gone into bankruptcy. But we don't live in a so-called free market. We live in a kind of bizarre species of corporate socialism. So in the end process of decayed states, you have forces in essence cannibalizing the state itself, which is where we are. I mean, a poor person of color on the streets of Camden, New Jersey are worth nothing to the state. Put them behind bars, they're worth $40,000 or $50,000 a year to prison contractors and food service companies and phone card companies. And that is something that is very real, but often not even understood by the victims themselves. Totalitarian societies seek to funnel all intellectual and emotional energy into spectacle, into the Super Bowl, into celebrity saga. It's why the Nazi Party made sure every single household got a free radio. And now you sit there and watch Basketball Wives. You see Jay-Z's crib and how many cars he has. And it's the great kind of pacifier. I wrote a book called Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, which is about the danger of unplugging yourself from a print-based culture. So I actively resist the attempts by popular culture, which of course is largely dominated by for-profit corporations, to give me a language by which I speak and an understanding of the world. Underneath the guise of consumerism is unadulterated hedonism. I mean, it's infected everything, including spirituality, which in its real form has nothing to do with us. It has to do with our neighbor. I mean, the whole point of, and again, I speak as a seminarian, of a life of commitment is picking up a cross. It's not a pleasant experience. It's one that gives one a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose. So, you know, I think that, again, it goes back to values which are largely an anathema to the consumer society. Those are values that are rooted in self-sacrifice. It's about giving. It's about self-effacement. It's about understanding that a life of fulfillment comes through service, not through the attainment and acquisition of money, wealth, and things. And I think that that wisdom, which sort of crosses all religious traditions, is real. I mean, creating community, and Freud wrote about it, Karl Popper wrote about it, brings with it a kind of anxiety and a kind of responsibility. And, you know, Freud would argue even a level of neurosis, because there's always that tension between individual desire and community responsibility. And I think that that tension is real, but one that's necessary. And the consumer society plays very well on that, magnifies that anxiety to push people into behavior which is not only destructive to the community, but finally deeply self-destructive. I covered the revolutions in Eastern Europe. I saw how lonely acts of defiance to totalitarian regimes, which at the moment were considered futile, kept alive another narrative, ironic points of light. That's what acts of conscience, acts of rebellion do. It appears often at the moment that it's meaningless. But when you stand up to decayed systems of power, systems of evil, and you speak a truth, even people within those systems hear your voice. And that's why the state is pushing through one draconian law after another, whether it's the wholesale spying and eavesdropping, monitoring, photographing of every American citizen, whether it's the use of the Espionage Act to shut down whistleblowers, whether it's the National Defense Authorization Act and Section 1021, for which I sued the president, federal court and won, which permits the U.S. military to seize U.S. citizens and hold them indefinitely without due process in military facilities. They're all doing this for a reason. They know what's coming. And I've covered uprisings all over the world. You know when the tinder is there. You never know what's going to trigger it. You never know when it's going to come. You never know how it's going to express itself, but you know it's there, and it's definitely here. The corporate state knows no limits at this point. It has no regulation, it has no government control, it writes its own laws, it writes its own legislation. So the rise of popular culture and the obliteration of real culture is part of this entire corporate totalitarian assault on beauty and truth. And that's what they have to seek to eradicate, because those forces are ones that remind us about how we should live and about what it means to be human. You know, going into Sarajevo, which I did during the war, where 2,000 children have been shot, 45 of my own colleagues have been killed, 4 to 5 dead a day, 2 dozen wounded a day, constant sniper fire, wasn't pleasant, but it was meaningful. And one, I think, has to begin to make that decision, whether they want a life that means something, or whether they want to leap from one hedonistic high to another. You can't talk about hope if you can't see reality, and reality is pretty bleak, but that's the starting point.
That was just one half of a comment. The remaining half you can download and listen to and watch Chris Hedges on what has happened to our society. And just go to prn.fm. Also, in case we, and specifically my Facebook page is down, washed off, which is entirely possible. It's irrespective of how many people are on it, and the fact that we publish multiple stories every day, reprint stories, original stories, videos. You can always get a backup at prn.fm. So if for any reason you go to Gary Noll Facebook and you don't see anything, then go to prn.fm, because we're duplicating everything on one site in case that day ever happens. After all, with all that we're doing to expose Wikipedia, and we have a lot more information. We haven't even gotten into the most important information yet. That's coming. And the alliances between these people in the internet world, it's very easy for them to retaliate. Hopefully they won't, but let's see. At least you have a plan B. Let's now immediately go over, because standing by on our phone is our guest. I gave you her background earlier on at the beginning of the program. Aline Christina Piva, that's P-I-V-A. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
The recent Brazilian election that has brought the former military officer Bolsonaro to power is in many ways, in my opinion, a sign of the failure of the left and democratic and labor forces that have run the nation in the past. The country was also in a deep recession when the elections took place, and it's somewhat similar to the conditions that gave rise to our own dictator wannabe Donald Trump and the failures of the Obama administration. However, unlike Trump, during the campaign season, this man, the new president of Brazil, is far more outspoken about his vision for Brazil, which would focus upon extremely conservative family values, anti-abortion, anti-LGBT rights, anti-welfare, anti-minorities, including indigenous peoples. He also espouses a fundamentalist position about religion, since evangelical and Pentecostal Christianity are strong in Brazil and voted in his favor. He supports a military to serve as law enforcement that would include death squads, torture, execution, and expanding the war on drugs. And finally, he is a hyper-neoliberal capitalist who utterly ignores the global climate and environmental crisis that would shift Brazil away from pan-Latin American solidarity and into the arms of the U.S. private corporate interests, the hedge funds, the equity partners, Wall Street. Consequently, the lungs of the planet, the Amazon, will be horribly affected with more deforestation, with the expansion of industrial agriculture, lumbering and mining. What I find most disturbing is that his agenda was never hidden, yet Brazilians seem to want this kind of government to take power now. So please explain the sudden and enormous shift from labor, since Brazil has very serious problems with poverty and unemployment, to what may very likely become a military dictatorship similar to the early days in the 1970s with military despotics running Chile, Argentina, Peru, and other Latin American countries. The forum is yours.
Yes, Gary, that's a question that I have been hearing a lot. You know, how a country such as Brazil, you know, with the size of Brazil, which has this, you know, very recent past of a brutal military dictatorship, ends up with a president that openly says that, you know, the mistake that was made by the military dictatorship was they didn't kill more. They had to kill about 30,000 more people to have done a great job. And he says that openly, very racist, xenophobic statements, everything that we have been hearing. So when we look at it, you see that it's not only an effect of the mistakes of the left, that many were committed, but, you know, they committed mistakes, but that wasn't the problem. Just during the elections, Steve Bannon gave an interview for one of the main newspapers in Brazil, and he said that what was going on there was one of the most important and successful psychological operations in recent years. So we saw the manipulation. They took to another level the politics of hate and fear that we saw on Trump's campaign in 2016. They took it to another level. Bolsonaro did not want the majority of the votes, but just as in the US, he won what he needed just to get elected. It's not the majority of the people. The people did not vote for him. And he ran in a platform that goes against everything that we achieved in the past decade and a half in the country. You know, might that be social advancements, healthcare, social security, education, even in very, very worrisomely in environmental laws that we have passed. The Amazon, for example, it's in a very danger point right now. As you said, you know, this is a trend that we are seeing throughout the world, where we are not discussing scientific facts anymore. We are discussing opinions. And he has the opinion that, you know, we don't have to protect the Amazon. But earlier this year, this magazine, this US-based magazine called Science Advances, they published a study that said that if the deforestation in the Amazon reaches a point of 25%, there will be no return. From that, we are just going to see a new level of degradation that we might not get back. And we are now seeing that we are at a point of 20% rate of deforestation. We are very, very close to that. And he has pledged, Bolsonaro has pledged, that he will actually open up the Amazon for, you know, any kind of enterprise that will put that in danger.
This is an extraordinarily dangerous person, Bolsonaro, B-O-L-S-O-N-A-R-O. My deep concern is Brazil's going into climate change denialism. Bolsonaro has already shown himself to be a conspiracy buff like Trump. He has ties with big agriculture, big mining industries, and this will not fare well with the Amazon. And the Paris Climate Agreement requires a huge reduction in deforestation, and he will do just the opposite. Therefore, can you speak about how he is not only a threat to Brazil, but he is a threat to the planet? You said 25%, you're 20% deforestation now. I have a new documentary I'm doing, and we have video of the water that starts at the top and goes through the Amazon, almost none is reaching the ocean. That's how much desertification is occurring. You actually have desert now at one time where you had one of the deepest, richest rainforests in the world. That's all disappearing at an enormous rate. And he could single-handedly bring quicker global destruction than any other human in world history. Are you aware of that?
Yes, exactly. We are talking about a candidate that is profoundly committed with an ultra-neoliberal agenda. And Brazil right now, the last frontier for, you know, expansion of agribusiness, expansion of mining and exploitation of natural resources in Brazil right now, it's the Amazon. We are talking about a place that is one of the richest environment in the whole world. In the past 2 years, since Rousseff was ousted, former President Dilma Rousseff, that was ousted in a very, very controversial impeachment process that many in the country, including me, believe it was a coup d'etat with the sole purpose of open up the country to big money, international, transnational capital interests, was ousted. The past 2 years, we saw the levels of deforestation in the Amazon going to historical high levels. What is going on to a world where we are seeing that the levels of climate change, the levels of changing in what we know as environment going to a fast pace? What is going to happen if we don't have what we so-called the lungs of the world, right?
Then Brazil will end up as a failed country. You are, as you know, the richest country in the west southern hemisphere as far as your rainforests and all that comes from that. But China's exploiting it. China's already got all the hardwood out of Peru and has contracts. So you're going to have people lining up because no one is saying, let's slow down. We're using natural resources if we had 2.5 planets. We only have one. I appreciate the good work that you are doing, Aline, and others with the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington and also with the Brazil Research Unit. And I want people to go to your website, coha.org, coha.org. I'm going to invite you back to talk about Haiti and popular Latin American movements that most people are not aware of. On an upcoming show, and I think we need an hour to go into this in some depth. So I look forward to having an hour conversation with you in the very near future. All right?
It will be my pleasure. Thank you so much, Gary.
By the way, just to let you know, I'm a big fan of Hugo Chavez, who, in my opinion, was a model Latin American leader, and many people didn't like him personally. Yeah. However, he achieved admirable social and economic reform in Venezuela, especially for the working class and the poor. And he made major efforts to unite Latin American nations into a trade bloc. Now, Bolsonaro is trying to sign a new direction in Latin America politics, and that would destroy everything that was built up before him. So we'll get into that in our next discussion. Yeah. All right?
Okay.
All the best to you. And that is Professor Aline Cristina Piva, P-I-V-A, and she is an expert on Brazil. And we will just spoke to us from Brazil, and we will continue with an in-depth one-hour conversation. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day. 1, 2, 3.